Well, good morning, y'all. Have you ever wondered how the whole Christianity thing kind of started out? I mean, we kind of take for granted, where it's at today, but who started it? How did it take off? And how did it get to the point that it's become so prevalent in the world today that even you, some 2,000 years later, come to church on a Sunday morning because you still believe in it? From just a handful of believers to now more than 2.5 billion or whatever the latest number is across the world, people are following Jesus Christ. And the Christian faith just really, from its very modest roots, just spread dramatically across the world. And you just kind of wonder, well, how did that happen? What was the beginning of that? And it starts with Jesus, obviously. And just after his resurrection from the dead, he had accomplished his mission. And so now it's time for him to return to the heavenly realms, back to the Father. And before he leaves, he gathers his disciples around him, and he says something that will become the beginning of what it is that we know today as the Christian faith. And he says, you, speaking to the disciples, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in all of Judea and Samaria, and even unto the ends of the earth. And after he said this, he was taken up before their very eyes until a cloud hid him from their sight. So, this is the last recorded statement of Jesus that we have while he was here on this earth, and it's commonly referred to as the Great Commission because he commissions the disciples to take the gospel out into the rest of the world, which there's a lot of implications that we're going to get into in a little bit. But what he's really kind of bringing them together and say, do you really understand what it is that I'm talking about here? I think that you're thinking too small. And if you try to keep this world-changing thing in this cultural box, it's not going to work. This thing that I'm talking about is bigger than just the region of Palestine, than just the region of Israel, than just the 12 of you. And Jesus' intention from the very beginning was that God was no longer going to be exclusively the God of the Jews, but his plan was that through his apostles, the gospel of Jesus Christ would now be for all people, for you people. But believe me, it wasn't going to be easy. So, we're still in this series that we've been doing for the last few months called An Overview of the Bible. And I want to piggyback on some of the things that Greg's been talking about over the last few weeks and opine a little bit on how that impacts how Christianity got its start. And it's interesting to note, I think, that up until this morning, really, from everything that we've studied from Abraham through the Gospel of John, through the first few chapters of Acts, has really been, what we've really been doing is studying the story of God through the lens of Jewish culture and understanding the history of the Jews in the fact that the Jews were God's chosen people, and it all goes back to that promise that, you know, God made to Abraham way back when. And so when you understand that, you see, you know, Jesus himself was Jewish, the disciples were Jewish, even the first church was Jewish. I mean, the first church, the mothership, so to speak, was the Church of Jerusalem, and it was led by Jesus's half-brother James, and the congregation was distinctly Jewish. So Christianity really began as a Jewish movement in terms of the demographic who were the first followers of Jesus at the time. And so there was this, you know, incredible connection between Judaism and the beginning of Christianity. However, While God wanted the Christian faith to start with the Jewish people, and he wanted the Jewish people to be the foundation of everything that he built, he really wanted it to now spread through the entire world and that it would become a faith that would be for all people. And one of the many problems with that, however, was that in Jewish law, a Jew could not be in relationship with or even in contact with a Gentile, which a Gentile is you, by the way, most of you anyway. It's basically anybody who is a non-Jew, and so we would be considered Gentiles in the Jewish tradition, and so it's a little difficult for a Jew to, you know, talk about Jesus with a Gentile when you can't even come in contact with him. So there was this tension between the Jewish culture and what they were now experiencing as a follower of Jesus. Listen to what Peter says in Acts chapter 10. Peter went inside, which this is in Cornelius' house, and he found a large gathering of people. And he said to them, look, you're aware that this is against our law for a Jew to associate with or visit a Gentile. But God has shown me that I should not call anyone impure or unclean. So obviously he's been judging the Gentiles. I now realize how true it is that God does not show favoritism, but he accepts everyone from every nation, the one who follows him and does what is right. So really the transition that is about to occur in Christianity, and by the way, it's not called Christianity yet at this point, it's about to begin with this aha moment of God showing Peter that there is something more than beyond the Jewish culture, that this thing is bigger than just them, that this Jesus thing is bigger than just their people, and he wants it to go worldwide. And so a debate, as you can imagine, as always happens, breaks out among all the Christians in Jerusalem as to whether or not they should A, be taking the Christian faith to the Gentiles in the first place, and B, what among the Jewish laws should they force a Gentile to adhere to if they actually become a follower of Jesus, not the least of which is circumcision, but we're not even going to go there this morning. But, you know, that's the things that they begin to debate and to kind of struggle with because they're in this kind of, you know, grown up in the Jewish customs and Jewish law and Jewish culture, but yet they're moving into this new thing that is emerging called Christianity. And to make a very long story short, Peter stands up and into what is known as the Council of Jerusalem, which is a critical moment in the beginning of the church and Christianity. And he has all the church leaders there that are gathered together to discuss this issue. And they not only decide to take the gospel of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles, but they also approve of Paul, Saul, to be just the person to do it, which is incredible. And not to diminish the work of the rest of the disciples, but one scholar put this moment about, you know, the blessing of Paul in this way. He says, apart from the resurrection of Jesus, the conversion of Saul was the most important event in human history. If Saul had remained a Jewish rabbi, and just remember that Saul was trained in the Jewish customs, but he was trained from the beginning to be basically a Jewish lawyer, that he was understood Jewish law and that he was groomed to be a Pharisee, the most elite of all the Pharisees, so that he could get a seat on the Sanhedrin. So he was molded from the beginning by his parents to be this, you know, Jew of all Jews. If Saul had remained a Jewish rabbi, we would not only be missing 13 of the 27 books of the New Testament, but the Christian faith would still be limited to the region of Palestine. And that's really important. Because if you think about it, and it makes sense to me that if you're God and you want to take this Christianity thing global, then who do you want to lead that charge? I mean, it's the guy who's most adamantly opposed to it. Right, the guy who's been staunchly against it and putting Christians in prison and persecuting them. I mean, if you want to have one person who could have the most impact in the Christian faith, there's no question that it would be Saul. And if you could then turn that passion that he had, this ruthless passion for persecuting Christians and chasing them down and having them in prison, and then turning him into becoming a completely different person, to becoming this fanatic about Jesus, where he's faithful, passionate follower of Jesus. If you could do that, like, nothing could stop this guy, right? So when you also consider the fact that Saul was born in Tarsus, which Paul describes, and I'm going to slip between Saul and Paul here for a few minutes, that when you realize that Paul was born in Tarsus, you know, Paul refers to that in the Bible as Tarsus as being no ordinary city, because it was the seedbed of Roman culture. It was very important from a trade standpoint, so people from all over the world came through it. Paul was uniquely exposed to all cultures from all around the world, whereas the rest of the disciples were pretty provincial and living their life in the small world of Palestine and Jerusalem and in that area in Judaism. Paul was exposed to a much bigger swath of civilization and people. So when you realize that he was born in Tarsus, which is now part of Turkey, the southeast part of Turkey, to a Jewish family who had dual citizenship, and they were, you know, grooming him to be this kind of really elite Jewish attorney in his education and upbringing, but he was also a Roman citizen with all the rights and privileges thereof. So he was really uniquely qualified to be able to go out into the rest of the world and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. He was fluent in Greek, which was the common language for the rest of the world. And if you remember back to our the message that we did from the intertestamental period, where I talked about that, you know, the time was right for the gospel of Jesus to be taken into the rest of the world. One thing was that for the first time you had a common language, that everybody spoke Greek. You were under one rule under the Roman Empire. Everybody was at peace at this time, and there were highways and roads so that you could actually travel the ancient world. So all of that paved the way for the gospel of Jesus Christ to take off. And so the Apostle Paul really understood Greek and Roman cultures. So when you think about, as Greg talked about last week, the conversion of Saul, where, you know, where Jesus confronts Saul on the road to Damascus, do you really think that was a coincidence? Like, was it just a random thing where Jesus is trying to save this one guy, or is it strategic? And, you know, I don't think it was a coincidence. We don't know for sure what God was thinking, but if I'm God, and you should thank God that I'm not God, this guy is as strategic of an acquisition as it gets to bring him onto the team in order to get that the expansion of the church to the ends of the earth, as Jesus describes in the Great Commission that he wants it to go through. So we have this then pivotal moment where in Acts chapter 13, verse 9, there's this kind of anticlimactical moment where Saul has gone through his conversion, he's been studying, he's been kind of going through things, and then all of a sudden, and Saul, who was also called Paul, like in passing, he just kind of barely mentions it. There's no fanfare or name-changing ceremony or anything. It's like Luke just slips in this little phrase that, oh yeah, by the way, Saul's name has been changed to Paul, like it's no big deal. But from this point forward, Saul is now referred to as Paul. The Bible never refers to him again as Saul. So this man, who was once a ruthless enemy of Christianity and was, you know, taking on Christians like never before, he takes on a new identity, and he's now referred to as Paul. The interesting thing about that is that his previous name was a very Jewish name. Saul was a name that was given to him by his parents, who were members of the tribe of Benjamin, and they gave him the name of Saul, which was the first king of Israel, a very prestigious king. And so they gave him the name of a king, and who, by the way, was from the same tribe. So he had this very Jewish name. But, you know, so I think that when his name changes from Saul to Paul, it's not only symbolic of the fact, because we usually tend to say, well, that's symbolic of the fact that he's taking on this new life and that he is, you know, renewed as a Christian now. He's a different person, and so it's symbolic about that. But truly, the name Paul was a very Greek name. And so I think what was really happening was he was being prepared to quarterback the Christian faith to then advance the cause into the rest of the world. And now if he had the name Saul, it would actually be a barrier for him relating to the rest of the world. But now with the name Paul, it was a connecting point that he had with other people because the rest of the world was very Greek in its culture. Simultaneous with that, the followers of Jesus also go through a name change. So in Acts chapter 11, this is the first time we get the title. It says the disciples were first called Christians at Antioch. Now, this is really important because this is where the Christian faith begins to slowly peel away from its Jewish roots. And it becomes less of a Jewish thing and more of a religion that is distinct and for all people, which is something that is transformative of what's been going on. It's here that being a follower of Jesus becomes not Jewish, but distinctly Christian, distinguishing themselves from the Jewish faith, which is a religion that goes on, obviously, to reject Jesus as the Messiah or the Son of God. So all that's going on at the same time. And then you have Paul, who begins to preach, and he begins to take the gospel of Jesus out into the world. And in Acts chapter 19, it says, God did extraordinary miracles through Paul, so that even handkerchiefs and aprons that had touched him were taken to the sick, and their illnesses were cured. In this way, the word of the Lord spread widely and grew in power. So really what was happening was God was working through Paul in incredible ways and giving him miraculous powers so that he could bear testimony to the power of God and that he was definitely authorized by God to speak the words that he was speaking. So God uses the Apostle Paul in these ways, and he went on to complete what we commonly refer to as the three missionary journeys, where he goes around the ancient world and spreading the gospel. And he, you know, it carried him to several countries, and he was shipwrecked and put in prison, and he was beaten and left for dead in an attempt to start what is an estimated 20 churches. So it's estimated that Paul started 20 churches in strategic locations around the world, which really then became the foundation for the Christian faith to then spread out and go global. Paul's final journey ends when he wraps up his third missionary journey, and he makes a fatal decision to go back to Jerusalem. And everyone is trying to convince him not to go. Everybody believes that he's in danger if he goes back to Jerusalem. He makes the decision to go back. And as you can imagine, much like during the ministry of Jesus, there is now this tension that's erupting between the Jews, who are feeling threatened by the Christian faith, and Christians. And the Jews are using whatever power they have to have Christians persecuted and even killed for their faith. So it's in this time, you know, you have the stoning of Stephen, who was notoriously stoned to death by the Jews. And in Acts chapter 21, it says that when Paul was in Jerusalem after the third missionary journey, that, you know, somebody started causing trouble, yelling at him, and then it kind of riled up this mob of Jews who began to just beat him. And the Roman soldiers come in and peel the crowds away. They stop the beating that's happening, and they arrest him. And I will just say this. If you have never read the last chapters of the book of Acts, I'd encourage you to read the whole book of Acts. But if you've never read like the last chapters of the book of Acts, it's fascinating reading. It really is, because it just shows the brilliance of the Apostle Paul from
beginning to, I mean, this guy was really, really smart. He not only understood Jewish law, but he also understood Roman law as well. So one of the passages that always strikes me that just shows the brilliance of the Apostle Paul, in Acts chapter 22, verse 25, it says, so they basically, the Romans save him from the mob beating, they arrest him, and now they're going to beat him, which was a normal custom back then. They were going to flog him. So Acts 22, 25 says, as they stretched him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty? And he knew the answer to that, right? And he's, instead of like yelling at him, hey, I'm a Roman citizen, he asked the question like in this really profound way. When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and said, hey, what are you going to do? This man is a Roman citizen. And the commander went to Paul and he said, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? Yes, I am, he answered. And then the commander said, I love this. He said, I had to pay a lot of money for my citizenship. And Paul said, yeah, but I was born a Roman citizen. Those who were about to interrogate him immediately withdrew. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a truly born Roman citizen, in chains. I mean, this is really, you know, cool stuff. Again, if you haven't read the end of the book of Acts, you really got to read this stuff. It's fantastic. So Paul is this really smart guy who understands all of the nuances of the customs and cultures, and he is just uniquely qualified to be the guy to advance the gospel, to take it to the rest of the world. And he really understands how to connect with people where he needs to. There's a great sermon that he gave in Acts 17, where he's standing in the Areopagus, and you know, he can't quote any scripture because nobody believes in any of the scriptures. And so he has these, you know, unique connecting points where he brings people back to creation and then through and teaches them about Jesus. But he's just really, I just have a lot of respect for who he is and his brilliance. But Paul, so after he gets out of this this flogging, he then is taken to the Roman governor, who Pontius Pilate has left, and so Felix is the governor at the time. And so as a way to appease the Jews, there's a lot of correlations really between the way that Pontius Pilate handled the trial of Jesus and how this whole thing was handled with the Apostle Paul and the governor at the time. But in a way to appease the Jews, he keeps Paul in jail for like 2 years. And so during that two-year period, the governor changes and now moves from Felix to Festus. Festus is trying to figure out why this guy's in jail. He calls King Agrippa, who's a Jewish king, and he tries to get an audience with him and help and have Paul present in front of him. And both of them are scratching their heads, you know, as to why he's even in chains. And so in the midst of this, while they're like finding him innocent, Paul, again, relies on his legal knowledge, and he says, I appeal to Caesar. In other words, he says, look, this court is like not fit for a Roman citizen. You have no rule over me, so I appeal to Caesar. Now, brilliantly, Paul has not been able to hit Rome yet to advance the gospel. Now, they have to take him to Rome for trial. So even though they probably would have cut him loose, he decides to stay in chains and travel to Rome because he wants to get an audience in front of Caesar and begin to advance the gospel in Rome. So he was eventually shipwrecked. He was acquitted in Rome. He spends the next couple years in Rome. But the Roman atmosphere is changing because there's a new emperor, and his name is Nero. I don't know if you guys have ever heard Nero. It's very well documented in history. Nero was one of the most evil emperors in all of Rome, who hated Christians, absolutely hated Christians. In fact, it's, again, very well documented that he actually took Christians, he would cover them in tar, he would put them up on a post, he would light them on fire to light his garden at night. So he had a fresh crop of Christians that he would kill every day. I mean, this guy was ruthless. And so things started to shift in the Roman Empire, and eventually the Apostle Paul is again arrested, only this time it's for real. And the tradition holds that in 67 AD, Paul is not only arrested, but he is tortured and then beheaded by King Nero. It's an amazing story of when you look at Saul's life and the beginning of the church and how that's all. But just to see how Saul's life, and this is where it relates to all of us, right? We were all raised, you know, in a particular way. I was raised in the south side of Chicago. There's a bias because I was a pastor's kid. I was raised as a Christian. I was groomed to be a pastor, right? And so you kind of just look at the way that you're raised and you go, okay, can you escape the mold of your life? And are you able to break free of that which was destined for you to become the person that God wants you to be? And, you know, Saul did that successfully. He broke the mold of being this kind of a Jewish Pharisee and person who was groomed to eventually get on the Sanhedrin. And he became something completely different. And he became somebody who was very passionate about his faith, even to the point of giving his life for what he believed in. And I think part of what drove Paul was that when you read his words, he was so remorseful of the things that he had done, that he had persecuted Christians and had Christians put to death. And he had this real guilt that he struggled with. And, you know, he truly understood the depth of his sin. And he truly got, like, what God had done for him and how he had changed his life. And he was just so grateful about it that he wanted to spend the rest of his life just saying thank you to God for what he had done for him. And so he became this witness on behalf of Jesus to talk about what God had done in his life. And, you know, when you go back to that passage that I read first in the Great Commission in Acts chapter 1, where it says that, you know, Jesus said that I want you to be my witness in Judea, Samaria, and the rest of the world. When you translate that word witness out of the Greek, this is really important because it is not the idea that it's somebody who can academically profess what they're talking about or that they're talking about rumor or hearsay. That word witness is to give a firsthand account of what you have experienced based on what you have seen and heard firsthand. That's really important because, you know, when Jesus passes the baton on to the 12 apostles for the Great Commission, they now pass it on to us. Like, that Great Commission is not just for them. That Great Commission, what Jesus is saying there is really for us too, because he's asking all of us to say, hey, like, he wants us to be a witness in this really dark world, to bring a light into this really dark world. And notice that Jesus doesn't ask you to be a biblical scholar. Jesus doesn't ask you to stand on a street corner and argue creation versus evolution. He doesn't ask you to go out and to prove scientifically that he raised from the dead or to preach at people. He just says, I want you to be my witness. I want you to speak firsthand about the experience that you've had in your own life, where you were, where you are now, and how God has transformed you into the person that you are now. Talk about that. Be my witness and bear testimony to what God has done in your life. I was at a business conference down in Miami this last week, and I got myself into an interesting situation. I was sitting at a dinner it was a long table, and it was about 30 guys in business suits, kind of the elite of business. And I didn't know any of them. And I'd gotten engaged in a conversation with a guy directly across from me who was from Chicago who wanted to do some business with me. And so he was trying to get some personal connection and ask me a few questions and somehow had Googled me and found out about this church thing, which is always an interesting conversation. And so he goes, now, how does that fit? Like, how does that fit in your life? And so I began to talk about Westridge and the start of Westridge, which led me then to talk about my faith and the story of my faith. Well, as I'm in the middle of this conversation, I realized all of a sudden that the six guys around me had all stopped their conversation, and they all were now listening to the story that I was telling. Everybody's wearing name tags, and it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out, as I did a quick assessment around the table, that every single one of them was Jewish. So I begin to, I'm at a crossroads, and I go, okay, I can either stop this thing now because it could get really ugly, or, you know, I don't know where this is headed, but I decide I'm going to plow right in. So I have to tell you, it was probably the highlight of my week, because it was like for the next hour, literally an hour, in a business conference, we're having this conversation about our beliefs and the struggles that we have with the faith, but it was just this honest conversation in a non-defensive way. And, you know, because Christianity is so Jewish, there were a lot of connecting points that, you know, I could make all the way along the way. But, you know, I wasn't sitting there preaching at them. I wasn't sitting there, you know, telling them that I'm right and they're wrong and, man, you really missed the boat on the Jesus thing, right? It was just this non-defensive conversation, and all I did was just share my personal experience about how God has changed my life. And, you know, to the point that a couple of them said, hey, we're going to come to Westridge, you know, and visit, so, which will be interesting. But being a witness for Jesus, as Paul was, it's not about arguing with people or preaching at them or trying to prove that you're right or they're wrong. And I get so tired of all of that because it's just, it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, like Paul, being a witness for Jesus is just sharing about who you used to be and who you are now and how God has transformed your life in some profound way to the point that you just want to share it, right? You just want to talk about it. And the difference between being religious and being a follower of Jesus, being a person of faith, is that we stop doing things because this is just the way that I was raised, that this is the mold that was created for me, to break out of that and to have this kind of catalytic moment where you want your life to be transformed and different, and you want it to be real, right? You want it to be authentic so that you can begin to now see, just like with Saul on Damascus, Jesus has encountered you. You have encountered Jesus for a reason. Like, it's not just random. You're here, and there's a point to you being here, and there's a strategic reason for you to be part of this world and to figure out what it is. The story of Paul in the beginning of the church is about having a mission that you believe in and to live intentionally in who you are and authentically to allow your faith to ooze out of you. I mean, when God decides to do something in the world, he always does it through ordinary people like you and me. He takes an ordinary, messed up person who's just struggling, and he uses us to do extraordinary things. And all he's asking is that we bring a little more of heaven into people's lives, and that we do the best that we can to push the gates of hell out of their lives and to bring a light and a mercy and a love that they've never experienced before. I think when we look at the life of Paul and we look at where he's come from and what he did and what he accomplished, I don't think that we can help but ask the question, why am I here? What am I doing? What's my mission? How am I living intentionally or not? What's the purpose? Because God wants me to be a witness, to simply share the experience that I've had where the love of God has changed my life forever.